Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is podcast number 117 for Friday, March the 9th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone. So far today, I have no co-hosts. Kai is still on travel and Nikki is asleep, and Baggy is asleep, and everyone in the house is either asleep or me. So, for however long that lasts, that will be the case. I wanted to start off with something that I was reading over. This was the other day. Well, I should back up and give a little bit. I was working on podcast notes, and I had worked several hours, and then I had a power flash. And I complained about this on yesterday's podcast, and I complained about it on Facebook and everything. But I brought it up now so that I can say this. Trying to go back and then put together what it was I was talking about on those notes prior to the power loss. And I came up with something that I did want to mention. So this is a couple days old. But anyway, so whatever. So I was reading on Lou Rockwell's blog. Now at lourockwell.com, he has the main front part of the site, which is links to liberty-oriented stories, and usually has one or two health-related stories. And then he has a link on there to the Lou Rockwell podcasts, and I think he generally makes about one new podcast a week. And they're, Lou Rockwell's podcasts are typically an interview with someone in the liberty movement. And then also, if you look around on Lou's site there, you'll see a link to Lou Rockwell's blog. And if you're not aware of it, it may not be all that obvious, because the site, you know, hasn't really changed a lot since Lou put it together in the early 90s. And so, it's the lourockwell.com is not about a flashy website. It's about, getting information across. So there's not a whole lot of bells and whistles there. But if you haven't noticed that, the Lou Rockwell blog, the button on the upper right hand side, it's always fun to check that out and see what's going on over there. So anyway, the other day, I was over there looking around, and one of the regular contributors to lourockwell.com put a post on there about his frustration with dealing with his Verizon cable TV listings. He received the so-called magazine that they send you that tells all about what is available on your cable TV, and it was almost useless to him. And so in attempting to figure out his what was actually available on his cable TV, he decided to go over to Verizon's cable TV website that's, to try to get more information on it. And when he got there, of course, Verizon's website was practically useless as well. And he commented on this, how many times that we see that kind of thing, where a company just has just a horrible website, and we think, how is it that these people function in the market? How is it that the market allows this? How, and I know that frustration. I get that every time I go to my TV, my cable supplier here is Time Warner, and it's also pretty much the only high-speed internet that's available in this area. I could go through a couple of the different phone companies, but the selection of service is all pretty much the same either way. And it's the same also if I go to the phone company's website, or even if I go to the website of my cell phone company. I face the same nonsense. It's just clunky, and it's nothing is obvious. It's very difficult to maneuver. And the same thing I find with websites like I try to go to Home Depot and just see if maybe I could order something, and rather than to find out if it was in the local store, if I had to order it, or what the deal was. And I found Home Depot's website is extremely cumbersome and slow loading, and it's just, I was not happy with it at all. And so I know the frustration that this contributor to Luke Rockwell, I don't want to name his name, partially because I don't have it in front of me in the notes, and also because I don't want to pick on the poor guy, but I understand the frustration of dealing with these big corporate giants that put together really, really bad websites. And I think he made mention of the fact that, how is it that these people do this? How does the market, with all the faith that we libertarians, and specifically those who understand Austrian economics, with all the faith that there is in the marketplace, how can these corporations let us down with such ratty websites? And of course, the reason why is because so many of the libertarians, and specifically those who are in the Austrian economics end of libertarianism, so many confuse this concept of the corporation with the market. The corporation is not a natural outcropping of the market. The corporation, the entire structure of the thing is more modeled after the state than it is the marketplace. If you think about it, I've talked before about how corporations promote the worst managers. They tend to punish the hardest workers and promote the ones who are better at politicking and less skilled at actual at actually doing their job. It's more about moving through a corporate structure is more about using politics to move up through the ranks than it is actual skills. Now I've saw that in the I was in the aerospace industry for quite some time, and I saw it in there. Some of the best engineers were just beaten down and just browbeaten to the point where they just sat at their desk and just put in their eight and went home, where some of the most successful managers were idiots. I mean, they were just idiots. I had one manager. Now, and I should clarify this just slightly. I was working in a crew of, there was like five or six. It varied according to different times. Sometimes as much as seven salaried individuals, and we were all making a good wage, and we all had some form or another of an engineering or technical backgrounds, and then we had probably close to 20 hourly employees that worked under us. We weren't direct managers over them, although there was one of us was always considered their supervisor, but pretty much we had the pool of about 20 hourly employees to do the legwork that we needed done. And then there was six or seven, sometimes maybe eight, of us that were salaried. And we all kind of had some kind of engineering or technical background. And then we had our manager. And, for the bulk of the time, that I was in the location that I'm describing, and I worked at quite a few different locations and quite a few different projects and everything. But I was at that location doing that. This was just outside of Cincinnati. I was there for a few years doing the same thing. And our manager was an absolute idiot. He was a nice guy. He was able to, do all the right things as far as what the company required of a manager. He was not threatening in any way to his manager, but he really didn't have any idea how to do pretty much anything at all that we were doing. He had no clue what we did. As a matter of fact, he didn't have the slightest idea what we did. But yet he was a perfectly successful manager within this major aerospace company. And the reason why he was able to do that is because that's the kind of person that's perfect in the corporate structure. A person who is not going to be smart enough to be a threat to the next manager up on the totem pole, and who can essentially get things done by having smart people work for them, but they don't necessarily have to understand any of it. And that's what the corporate structure promotes, and that's what it creates. And this is pretty much the same within government. I worked on quite a number of different government contracts, both when I worked, I think I've mentioned before that I worked for some time at General Electric Aircraft Engines in their engineering and engine design in creating and testing experimental engines and so forth like this, and trying to improve designs on existing engines and everything. But before I worked for General Electric, I worked for a variety of different companies in the aerospace industry, and I contracted as well. Some of my work was working directly for companies, and some of it was contracting through separate companies. And so I worked for the Department of Defense. I worked for NASA. I worked for, all these different people. And I encountered a lot of government employees. And the government does exactly like corporations as far as, if someone is a real go-getter and they're really sharp and they're really smart and they really, really want to do a good job, they're not going to get promoted because they're a threat to the next boss over them. That boss doesn't want them up at a peer level because they're going to make him look bad. So he'd rather keep that guy down and promote some slug that can barely tie his own shoe, because now we've created a situation where the next manager up is going to look down and see, the common layer of all these lower level managers, and any one manager is not going to stand out as being brilliant among them because they've all made sure that nobody smart gets up into the ranks. And this same process echoes through all layers of government from the top to the bottom, and it pushes the brightest and the most enthusiastic down while rising up the most mediocre of them. Now, you don't want troublemakers, you don't want completely lethargic idiots, but you want those mediocre ones. And that's what managers tend to rise up, is other mediocre managers, so that they're not threatened by them. And as this process continues, the longer the process continues, the more, the lower the medium level of mediocrity becomes. Because you're constantly pushing the best down and pulling whatever is mediocre back up. And so this process has a tendency to make sure that generation after generation, whatever the standard is constantly getting lowered. Well, this happens in government, but it also happens in corporations because corporations are an entirely false entity created by government rules and regulations. So corporations fall victim to the same thing that we have to deal with governments. So when you see these major corporations, Verizon, Home Depot, Time Warner, when you see these companies and you go to their websites and you think, man, I have a 12-year-old nephew that could design a better website than this. This is why. There's no incentive in their market. All the incentives that they face, I shouldn't say all, there's still some market pressures on these companies. But the vast majority of the pressure that they face is not market pressure. It's internal pressure, internal politics driving them more towards mediocrity. Especially companies that are in the cable TV business, they don't have to compete with anybody. If Verizon has a local contract, their area is pretty much exclusive to Verizon. And if another company is Time Warner, if they have a local contract, they have the contract. They have these government-created monopolies. So why should they break their back in making their websites fully functional? All they have to really do is make sure that the manager who oversees the website can make a nice display, a nice PowerPoint display for his manager and say, look how functional our website is. And he can do that in a PowerPoint presentation in a boardroom and never actually have to pull up the computer and let any of them do any of the functions within the website. So, for example, you take any one of these big companies' websites. You take a small website like take badquaker.com, for example. Now, any of us here on the badquaker.com staff, which that's, me, I'm a contributor, I'm an unpaid contributor. My wife owns the website and administrates it. And then we have Kai, and formerly Kai's husband, John, helped us out before his passing. And we also have my other daughter and her boyfriend, and between us, any modifications that we make to the website or any suggestions that any of us might make or whatever, ultimately we end up going to that website and clicking those buttons and seeing how it works and why it works and making sure that it does the things that we expect it to do. But if you take a big company, whether it be any of the ones I listed or bigger companies or whatever, they don't have the same level of motivation to ensure that everything on there is functional. Let me pick on Time Warner Cable for a moment. Back in September, when my mother-in-law first started getting ill, we had to pack up everything, jump in the motorhome, and head across country to be with her while we were trying to figure out what was making her ill. And so from a remote location, now I had the normal way that we paid bills while we were still at home. I had my Time Warner Cable bill set up through my bank. So once a month, I would just go into my bank through the website at my bank. I would pull up my bill paying panel. I would check mark the bills that I wanted to pay. I would fill in the amounts that I wanted to pay, and I would hit the little button, and my bank would take care of that. And I might mention that I have a small local bank, so it functions very well. There's a motivation there because all the people who run the bank and all the managers of the bank and all the bank presidents, everyone is local. I can literally walk down the street and talk to the people that run my bank. So their website is very functional. Now, so we hit the road back in September, and we start heading across country. And as the weeks burn by, and as the month burns into the next month, and we're back and forth across country, I end up, I'm going to have to pay my bills remotely. Well, stupid me, the laptop that I took with me, I didn't have the proper stuff to get logged into my bank website with. So I thought, well, I'll just pop over to Time Warner Cable's site, pull up my bill, and pay it on their site. And, well, I hadn't tried to do that in several years, and they'd updated their site since the last time I was there. So here I am on Time Warner's website. I find the little button that says pay your bill. I've already logged in and everything. I hit the button to pay your bill. It opens a new window, goes right back to the same page with the little button that says push here click here to pay your bill. I'm like, So I push the button again. It opens a whole new window, comes back to the exact same site with the exact same button, click here to pay your bill. And I'm like, what's going on? Because it's not obvious immediately that it's opening new windows each time. So I clicked it 5 or 6 times trying to get it to go. I tried right-clicking on it, see what the properties are of the button. Then it dawns on me, I've got like 5 windows open and they're all the same window. You see, Time Warner had put together a whole new look to their website, but they didn't actually go through and click everything to make sure it all functioned. So, and what was the part that didn't function? The part where they get money from me. They couldn't even get that part right. Now, can you imagine a company like, some small company? Well, our sponsors, Survival Gear Bags, Kelly, make sure if something's not right on that website, he doesn't get money. That's important. If somebody doesn't get the things they ordered, it comes right out of his pocket. He has an absolute one-to-one responsibility with his customers to make sure that every aspect of that website works and every customer is satisfied, because every customer means it's a direct part of his income. But you see, Time Warner doesn't have that problem. If I can't pay my bill on Time Warner, guess what? They'll just charge me a late fee and threaten to cut off my service. And they don't care if it's because their button on their website doesn't work. Pay me. There's a scene in what is that movie? Oh, Goodfellas. That's what it was. There's a scene in the movie Goodfellas where a guy is having problems with some of the local mafia thugs, so he goes to a higher mafia thug to try to get the lower mafia thugs off his back. And so the higher mafia thug ends up coming in and taking part of his business. And so the voiceover person, Ray Liotta, does the voiceover telling the story through this. He says, now that Big Polly was part of the business, it didn't matter. Business is slow. Too bad. Pay me. We don't have enough customers. Too bad. Pay me. You see, Polly doesn't care. Polly doesn't care what your little problems are. Pay me. He gets his cut even if there's no business. And that's kind of the attitude. It's a little bit different, but that's kind of the attitude these big companies have. Time Warner says, you can't go on the website and get the pay button to work? Too bad. Pay me anyway. They don't care what your little problem is. You call them up, they'll put you on hold for 15, 20 minutes while they... You know what? Here's a problem I had with Time Warner Cable. Last year, this was going back early part of last year, I can't remember all the details involved, but it was like a Thursday night, I believe. I could be wrong on this, but I believe it was like a Thursday night, and and the cable goes out. It was late at night, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and the cable goes out. And that means the phone is out, the internet is out, everything. We're dead in the water. So I tell everybody in the household, well, you know, if they don't get it back on by tomorrow, I'll call them. So the next morning I call, and I wait and wait and wait on hold, and eventually they get around to talking to me, and I tell the guy, hey, you know, the cable's been out all night. And he says, okay, well, it looks like we've got an outage in your area, so it's part of that outage, so we'll get to it as quick as we can. All right, okay, so... No, you know what? This didn't happen a Thursday night. It happened a Friday night because when I called in the morning, it was Saturday. So it was Saturday morning I call, and the guy basically wanted to get me off the phone as quick as possible. So he says, oh yeah, there's an outage in your area. We've got people there. We've got people in your neighborhood working on it. We'll get you back up as quick as possible. So all of Saturday goes by, nothing. Sunday morning, I call back again. Now, in the meantime, I've actually driven around the neighborhood and I've looked, and there's no Time Warner guys working anywhere in the neighborhood. So I call back and I'm like, hey, what's the deal here? Oh, we've got people working in the neighborhood. We'll get you back online. No. You told me that yesterday. I've driven around the neighborhood. There's nobody working in the neighborhood. Now I want to know how come I don't have any function here. Oh, well, let me put you on hold. And he doesn't put me on hold. The line, because I can see it, I'm not using my landline to call him. I'm using my cell phone. And it says on my cell phone that he disconnected me. He didn't put me on hold. He disconnected me. You know why? Because it was shift break. He's getting ready to leave. He didn't want to take up a half an hour phone call trying to deal with me. He wants to get through his numbers and take as many calls as he needs to, register them as good. He knows it's a weekend. Nobody's monitoring his call. So he'll just get, he knows I'm going to be a trouble because he's going to have to actually do something. So he'll just hang up on, tells me he's going to put me on hold and hangs up on me. So I call back and I can't remember now, but I think the total took something like 4 calls or something like that before I finally got somebody who just the personality, you could tell this was a person who wanted to help me and wanted to do her job. But you could tell by the previous personalities that they could care less. And yet, within the structure of Time Warner Cable, these people continue to keep their job. There's nothing to root them out. Oh yeah, their manager has some level of motivation to catch them doing these things. But not so much. And so that's what I had to deal with. And this is entirely not what you face when you deal with a real company that the pressures of the market work on. All right. Well, I wasn't really going to ramble on that long, but I guess my real point in that is that the corporations, so often the Austrian economists will confuse the activities of Walmart or of IBM or of Apple computers, or they'll confuse those people with the free market. Apple computers or Walmart or IBM or General Electric is to the free market what Congress is to anarchy. It's the exact opposite. These giant corporations that utilize the force of the state are no different than Congress. They're no different than the mainstream media. They're no different than the banking industry. They're all tentacles of that same beast that is the state. They only exist because of the aggression of the state. If you don't believe it, think about it just for a minute. Who do those big companies compete with? They compete among themselves Yeah, but the way that they share the load, there's really no true competition among them. They all find their little segments and they work it all out together. And if one of them becomes a threat to the other, then there's mergers, and they end up figuring out government authorized monopolies of whole segments of the market. Well, that's not a free market. A free market, every little mom and pop store competes, and they compete equally. And they don't have to deal with a lot of regulations that cause them to have to jump through hoops and hire whole teams of attorneys just to tell them how they can and can't design their sign, or how their doors have to open and close, or whether or not they, how the lighting has to be in the buildings and how to set things on the shelves. They don't have teams of attorneys telling them all these things. They don't have, banks of lawyers working to make sure that they can't be sued in any possible way that by their employees, or negotiating in mass with unions for contracts. I'm getting beside myself. I can't even talk about it. Small companies do not have to deal with that kind of stuff. They can't. If when they try to, they get crushed. So they just can't compete with those things. And yet the big companies know that, so the big companies use that and use the aggression of government to force those little companies to either have to spend the money on all those layers and layers of stuff, or else they get shut down because of silly regulations. All right, that's a long enough ramble on all that. So let's interrupt for our commercials. Since I've already halfway given Kelly a commercial over there for survival gear bags, might as well make it official. So here comes the commercial. Stick with us. It's only 2 minutes long, and we'll be right back. I'll be right back. I'm by myself today, so I'll be right back. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. All right, so I was talking about how corporations end up creating a non-market situation where, due to utilizing the aggression of government, they have price controls, they have a controlled market share, they have the corporate company structure insulates the managers from the customers, so the managers end up being better at being at politics rather than actually running a business. And that creates a situation where the worst managers, or at least the mediocre managers, are promoted and the best are pushed downward. Okay, now, one of the other things that I was working on when the power dropped the other day and I wiped out all of my files, I had, you know, there's a whole concept that I've been a little hesitant to just throw out to the listeners. And part of the reason why is because in my mind, I'm thinking, well, this is pretty radical for a lot of people. And so I've hinted around at it, and I've beat around the bush, and I've poked at it, but I very rarely have really laid it out and said, look, here's the thing about the state. This is what the state really is. Now, I do a lot of talking about the state, and a lot of times I've inferred this, or I've worked to build a case towards it, but I very rarely just throw it right out, you know, right out there. And then I was listening to the Freedom Fiends podcast, and Nima Vadadi on the Freedom Fiends podcast just comes right out and says it. He just says, just right out, there it is, here it is. And he just says it, and they just go on about their business like, oh yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, why have I been so hesitant to say this? Well, I know why I've been so hesitant. Have I got you curious as to what it is I'm talking about? But why have I been so hesitant? Well, because I have not actually sat down and laid out the entire thing in a completely logical way so that nobody can attack it. I didn't want to lay out such a radical idea just one piece at a time without the entire structure in a way that it could be defended, that the idea could be defended in every possible direction. I didn't want to put it out one piece at a time. And then Nima just spits it right out like, oh yeah, there it is. So what is it I'm talking about? Well, Nima was talking about Jesus, and he was talking about, and I should give a disclaimer here. For all the non-Christian listeners, or for all the non-theist listeners, stick with me on this. It may be a little bit boring to you. I'm not trying to require that anybody believe what I believe religiously or anything like that. And keep in mind, you know, I don't think Nima is a Christian at all. So he was essentially telling the subject matter was about Christians in general anyway. So Nima was laying out the argument, well, why do they believe that when they believe this? So I'm not necessarily even, I don't think Nima's a Christian, or I'm not projecting onto him any particular beliefs of any kind. So that's not my point. But anyway, so he was talking about when Jesus was taken up and viewed all of the earth and all of humanity, and Satan showed him all the great kingdoms of the earth, and he was whisked about through, it kind of indicates, I probably should reread it to make sure that I'm clear on this, but if I recall, it indicates that he saw all the kingdoms through time, but he saw all the great kingdoms of the earth. And Satan is tempting Jesus, and Satan says to Jesus, if you will, you know, basically get on my side, we can work together, we can do this as a team, and I'll give you all of these. And Nima points out, you know, that because the state, that's what Satan was offering to Jesus, the state. And the state is the realm of Satan. And Jesus rejected the state when he rejected Satan at that point. And so Nima just spits it out like, oh yeah, you know. And Michael W. Dean is the other person over there on the Freedom Fiends podcast. And Michael just kind of passed it on through, didn't make a big deal about it or anything, like, oh yeah, 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 you know. And then Michael W. Dean commented that, oh yeah, well, you know, you think about it, it was the state that killed Jesus anyway, because he was such a, he was fine as long as, you know, as long as he stayed over there teaching and making fishes and stuff. As soon as he starts messing with the banking industry and starts knocking over the money changers' tables, now he's a problem. We need to go take care of this guy. And so it was actually the state that killed Jesus. And there's some variations of that, and I'm not going to get into the whole theology of that, because there's some mistakes in that logic, but there's a lot of truth in that logic too. But anyway, so Nima just spits this thing out. And I have been painstakingly attempting to put together this perfect argument so that I could present this entire logical, this whole logical process and this whole theological structure in a way so that atheists and theists and Christians and Muslims and Jews and Protestants and non-Protestants and everybody could look at my theory and not be able to pick a single part of it apart. And in doing that, I just never presented it. And then Nima just spits it out like, oh yeah, there it is. Well, yeah, that's the thing. The realm of the state is the realm of Satan. You think about it just from that example there where Jesus was taken up and tempted by the devil. Well, let's look at it this way. Was Jesus an idiot? Could Jesus fall for a simple con? Well, the average Christian would say, no, Jesus was not an idiot. No, Jesus could not fall for a simple con. Well, then, that being the case, would Satan be stupid enough to waste his time on a con that he knew that Jesus would be able to see right through? Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, so what is more likely here? What is more likely is that Satan was actually offering Jesus something that Satan possessed. It wouldn't have done Satan any good to offer something that Jesus could just say, dude, you don't even own that. What are you offering me that? You don't even own it. Of course, that wouldn't be a very logical scenario. And Jesus wouldn't actually be tempted if Satan really didn't own the kingdoms of the earth. Because Satan does own the kingdoms of the earth. It is the realm of Satan. Or in a natural law setting, if you take away the concept of God is existing at all, and we just deal with natural law, then we come back to what I was talking about with the Garden of Eden setting in other podcasts recently, where it's clear that when man obeys natural law, the same as a squirrel hoarding nuts, or the same as a bat following the laws of nature that regard a bat can fly. But if a rat tried to do what a bat does, a rat would fall to the ground. So there are natural laws that regulate how squirrels behave and how bats behave and how rats behave. And there are natural laws that regulate how humans behave. But at some point in time, man took it upon himself to create a brand new entity, the state. And he gave that entity deistic qualities, the ability to make new, entirely new laws based arbitrarily on whatever humans want to be the law. You see, man created a god, and the name of that god is the state. It is a myth. It's an idea. It's a false god that men believe in, and because men believe in that false god, they act on behalf of that false god. And thus we have governments utilizing the aggression of the state with the justification that the state is real. And that is Satan. That is his realm. And I would even argue that that is what Satan is. Satan is the god that man creates in his mind when he believes that the state is legitimate. Now that's a little bit more radical than what Nemo said, but that's what I've been beating around the bush at and not really presenting, because I didn't have an entire theological and logical structure to put it out so that no one could attack the edges of it. I've been delaying doing that, and that's actually what I was one of the things that I was working on in my notes when the power popped on me. And of course my first thought is, a stinking devil took out my power. Of course not. That was not really it. But so then on this same theme, and just to give a little bit further information to back it up, if you haven't heard me talking about this stuff already, I don't want to go into a huge theological analysis and, you know, start quoting a bunch of biblical scripture, or I don't want to do a whole lot of that. So, since Nima just threw this thing out, and since now I'm just basically doing the same thing, just throwing out overviews and not really providing any real substance to support what it is I'm saying. But just keep in mind this idea that sin entered when man chose to be the lawgiver. Man made the state. Man created the state as a man-made God. Now, if you want to further think about this, and I've talked about this before, but if you go over to the 8th chapter of Samuel in the Bible, you get this story of where the Israelites rejected God and demanded a state. And at first, the prophet Samuel was a little upset about this, and he's like, God, what are they doing? They're rejecting me. And God's like, no. When they ask for a state, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. You see, that's the question right there. Do you want the state, or do you want liberty? And yeah, I'm saying exactly what yes. The state of liberty, the state of having no state, the condition, I should say, of having no state, is what God designed us to have. Or if you're the atheist or whatever, it's what nature designed for us. Nature didn't design a state for us. Let's make the comparison to the anthill. An anthill is a really odd thing. An anthill functions as if it knows what it's doing. If you spend a little time, and mostly adults don't do this, but, you know, I'm an adult with repeated head injuries, so I do goofy things like sit around and watch ants for 4 or 5 hours at a time, 3 or 4 days a week for 2 or 3 months or some stupid thing like that. But and that's not an accurate estimate, that's just a wide overview. I'm not saying that that's specifically how much time I spent watching ants, but I have spent way too much time watching ants. I won't deny that. But an anthill functions in a fascinating way. The anthill itself, now I'm not talking about individual ants, I'm talking about this larger entity, this anthill. It has a form of intelligence. It knows how to do things. It knows how to defend itself. It knows how to move itself. It knows how to bring itself into a new area. It knows how to deal with a conflict with another existing ant colony. It understands how to do all these things, and yet not one single ant is aware of the colony. Not one single ant knows that the colony does these things. They don't have each ant. Like I've talked before about milkmaid ants. Milkmaid ants will go and there are herding ants that will go out on, like for in my case in my garden, they will go onto my grapevines and they will capture aphids and they will snip their wings off and they inject them with a mild narcotic. And this makes the aphid very docile and hungry. And so the aphid will begin, you know, eating the grape plant leaves. And as it eats the leaves, these herding ants will bring all these aphids that they have disabled and drugged, and they'll bring them all on one leaf. And they'll begin consuming one leaf. And then nursemaid ants will leave deep down underground in the colony. Nursemaid ants will come up out of the colony in a row, spaced a certain distance apart, and they will come and milk the juices from the aphids and get a whole mouthful of it. Not a mouth, they have mandibles that stick out of the front, but they'll get this little ball of liquid that they hold in their mandibles, and they'll milk that from the aphids, and they'll bring it all the way back down into the core of the ant colony. And they'll make a nonstop string of these milkmaids that will just go back and forth and back and forth. And actually, they're not maids. They're probably all drone males, but you get the point anyway. And they will, the herding ants will herd the aphids. A series of soldier ants will come out, and they'll place themselves at different places on the grapevine to protect the herds. And each different kind of ant has its own task in this. And none of these ants know what's going on. Not one of these ants has any concept as to what is happening. And yet, this thing functions as one living being. The whole anthill is more like one animal than it is the millions of little tiny ants that make up its whole. And that's kind of how the state is, except the state is not the natural, is not the natural condition of man. You see, that colony of ants, that anthill, that's the natural condition for those ants. But it's not the natural condition for mankind. But the state functions just like that overpresence of the anthill. It's like something that exists outside of the mind of the individual ant. They all adhere to its will, and yet none of them have any way to reach out and touch that overbearing conscious that controls that anthill. Except with humans and with the state, that thing that we create in our mind, that thing that we obey when we believe that those in government have a greater power and can make the laws and inflict those laws upon us, that thing that we conceive of in our mind that says, yes, this guy can make traffic move along or stop people he wants in traffic because he's sanctioned by the state. You can tell he has a costume. He has a little metal badge. You see? It's okay if he carries a gun, and it's okay if he gets upset that you might have a gun. It's okay because he's sanctioned by the state. He's sanctioned by that over thing, that colony consciousness that we all believe in. Except that's not the natural state of humankind. That's Satan. Jump over, okay, to Ezekiel chapter 28, and Ezekiel chapter 28 is the description that's generally believed to be a description of Satan. Go over there and read it. It describes him as being, it says that he is a being that's perfect in beauty, gifted in music. It calls him perfect in his ways. Well, he was originally that under those conditions. He was gifted in music, perfect in beauty, and perfect in his ways. And he was originally located in the Garden of Eden. Now, that's what Ezekiel chapter 28 tells us. And this is, again, the scripture most people use. There's only a couple of actual references to the devil or to Satan or to Lucifer or whatever you want to call him. There's only a couple references to him in the whole Bible, and this is the most clear of all of them. And how does it describe him? It describes him as being perfect in beauty, gifted in music, and perfect in his ways, and originally located in Eden. And then it says that there was a flaw, and he fell from grace and was cast down and rejected by God. And why did that happen? Because he attempted to make himself a god. And what does that mean? It means he tried to be the lawgiver. He tried to make himself to be the lawgiver. You see, Satan, that devil, whatever you want to call him, is the embodiment of sin. And it is that is the myth of the state. All right, since I've kind of made this into the giant, massive religious podcast for today, and I really didn't intend for it to be that, it's Nima's fault. Blame Nima. Nima Vedati. It's his fault. He did it. He got me thinking about this, and he just spit out this stuff like it was casual, and so that inspired me to just ramble on like this. So it's Nima's fault. Yep, that's what it is. Okay, so, but since I'm on that realm, or since I'm in that realm of discussion, then I might as well pick on somebody else over at lewrockwell.com. There's a different article that came up the other day over there called War, Social Values, and Ron Paul. And it's by a gentleman by the name of John, I believe it's Utley? Probably Utley. And I don't know much about this gentleman. I'm sure he's probably a good guy. I'm sure he's probably very intelligent, and I'm sure he probably is, a great person. Probably be great to know. I'm not in any way trying to make a judgment against him in any way. But so he writes this article over at Lou Rockwell, and I'm not going to just go through and pick him apart line by line, but he starts out and he says, this is the first line of his article. It says, "Is supporting war more important for evangelicals than their social values? Isn't Ron Paul a social conservative? He opposes abortion, gay marriage, promiscuous sex. He has never been divorced and certainly supports family values, but he believes in limited government. Two of his brothers are ministers. Why then are evangelical leaders now opting for Santorum and before him Gingrich? The one big area of disagreement with Ron Paul is war, foreign wars, and the domestic one against drugs. For this, they oppose him. Santorum supports unending war in Afghanistan, backing Israel without limit, and a new war in Iran." Okay, so now that's the introductory paragraph to John Utley's article, War, Social Values, and Ron Paul. And so he goes on in this article to essentially say that the reason that evangelical Christians do not like Ron Paul or don't support Ron Paul, or the reason they do support people like Rick Santorum or Newt Gingrich or whoever the flavor of the day Republican is, he's making the argument that the reason why is because really they're more in support of war than they are their supposed social conservative values. And that's the argument he makes. And he goes on to state the argument over and over. And on the surface, he appears to make a fairly good argument for this. He gives some supporting evidence and so forth. But here's the problem. I'm not going to spend, let's see, I only have a few minutes left in the podcast today anyway. And I made a wisecrack about this the day that it posted at Lou Rockwell. I said, I could go and kick on the mic right now and do a whole podcast just taking this article apart. But I'm not going to because it's the low-hanging fruit. It's so easy to pick apart. And so now here I am picking it apart. But I only have a couple minutes left, so I'm not going to really go through line by line and pick this poor guy apart and do to him what I've done to Walter Block and some of the others over there at Lou Rockwell. What the real problem is that this guy paints all or most evangelicals with the same brush that he's already assumed in his mind is valid, and it's just simply not valid. When he says that supporting war is more important for evangelicals than their social values, that's just nonsense. It's insultive to all Christians, specifically those of the evangelical, and I'm not an evangelical Christian. So I can sit here and say this. I'm not an evangelical Christian. And still, buddy, what's his name? Hold on, let me look at his name. Utley. You're just discriminating against an entire group of people for you've created the straw man argument that fits what you want them what in your mind you want them to believe, and you've given yourself this opportunity and this excuse to beat them up. But they don't actually, they're not one people. The evangelical Christians are not one people with one giant harmonious set of beliefs. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of them aren't paying attention to Ron Paul or Rick Santorum or any of the others. They're not paying attention. Now, if we want to pick on this specifically, if you want to pick on evangelical ministers, specifically evangelical ministers that have an agenda, now we have something we can talk about. Now we have a very tiny group of people who make their living off of distorting things like the war on drugs or the war in Afghanistan. They make a living feeding false and distorted propaganda to their flocks in order to fortify their own positions and get more money. So if you're going to enter this realm of beating up evangelicals, at least take a little bit of a look and see who it is specifically that we're talking about. Because it's not the rank and file evangelicals. It's not the rank and file Christians that are the problem. That's like attacking the Mormons for supporting, what's his face? What's that other clown's name? Mitt Romney. That's like attacking the Mormons for supporting Mitt Romney. And saying, well, it's because Mormons want war and because Mormons this or that. No, no, no. If you want to attack specific Mormon leaders because specific Mormon leaders are supporting Mitt Romney, who supports killing more people, then name them and tell who you're supporting or tell who you're attacking. But don't just attack Mormons in general, because a lot of Mormons have looked at this situation and they do not support Mitt Romney. A lot of Mormons think for themselves, and a lot of Mormons don't care. They're not really involved in politics. They're not really paying attention, and they don't know who Ron Paul is, or they don't know the specifics about it, and they don't really know about the wars and all this kind of stuff. Because a lot of people in society just don't follow this stuff. But when you separate out one group like the evangelicals, or in my example, the Mormons, or you could do the same thing with Catholics. Rick Santorum is a Catholic, and he gets some degree of Catholic support. But you can't throw all Catholics under the bus just because some Catholic leaders support a fellow Catholic. That is entirely disingenuous. Utley, why would you do that? Unless you are intentionally distorting the argument in order to beat up one specific group. Is there some other reason, Utley, that you would do that? So I said I wasn't going to go through line by line and take this guy apart. I will say, though, that he goes on to talk about how, you know, all the whole article, he just lumps all evangelicals into the same bucket and just assumes that they all think alike and they all act alike and they all do exactly the same things. And it doesn't matter what group you're doing that too. If you're putting all Muslims in a group like that and assuming that they're all the same, or if you're putting all Catholics, or if you're putting all Mormons, or if you're putting all Pentecostals, or if you're putting all in any particular segment that you want to do that, all libertarians, if you want to take all libertarians. This was the problem with Walter Block saying that there's no possible way you could be a libertarian and not support Ron Paul. That's just stupidity. It's either one of two things. It's either choosing not to think, or it's using your opportunity of the bully pulpit to beat people for not supporting who you think they should support. And so I think, Utley, that might be what you're doing. I think, Utley, what you're doing is you're trying to intimidate and embarrass evangelicals because they don't support Ron Paul. I don't think that's a very honest way of gaining support for any particular politician or any particular theology or political position or thought or belief. You know, I think it's more like, I'm not sure who it was that said it. It seems to me like Mises said it, but I'm sure others said it as well. Probably someone like Gandhi or somebody said it. So I'm not sure who the original origin was, but whoever it was that said that an idea, when the time comes for an idea, that it no gun or no sword can stop it, no government can stop an idea. I'm not sure who the original speaker of that phrase was, and I certainly butchered the phrase itself. But I put it a different way. I've said it like this: when the market decides that it wants liberty, the market will have liberty. And it won't matter if Ron Paul is alive or dead, and it won't matter if Ron Paul is the president or just a doctor somewhere. And it won't matter what all the people that believe in the state and all the goons that are willing to use violence and aggression to enforce the will of the state, it won't matter what any of those people want or say or do. When the time comes that the market says, it's time for liberty, we will have liberty. But before that time, All we can do is spread the idea. All we can do is sell the concept. And you're not going to sell the concept to people by belittling them and by shoving them all into the same box and treating them all like they're idiots. You're not going to sell liberty to people by browbeating them like that, Utley. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening. Thanks a lot, folks.